And I was telling about Diane, and it just amazed me how fast her reaction was of responding to the baby. And that's probably very similar to the reaction that mother had when the baby fell in the water. She was across the pond and lifted the baby out of the water before anyone else could actually get there. We enjoyed the swimming outings we had. This was a very interesting park out there where the natatorium was in Boise. It also had a big dance hall that I spoke of earlier, where I went to the first public dance that I ever went to when I was 15. And it was they had professional dance orchestras, and there were other like concession type things, and they generally held their fairs and their carnivals in that area. Not too far from there, also out in that direction, was where the Boise River came into town, and there was the dam on the river was just a few miles out of town that direction. And whenever we could talk anyone into taking us out there, there was a group of us boys who, I was around 12, it was after I had joined the Scouts and I was around 12 to 14 years old, that we would go out as often as anyone would take us to go out and swim in the river. Just below the dam, there was a spillway came off the dam that created quite a whirlpool effect in the water. And there was a big cement abutment that came out and was on a slope and then leveled out just about above water level. And we would go out and climb onto this cement, and then we would jump or dive into the water where the whirlpool was. And it would keep you swirling in an area there for until you finally had to either kick your way or let the natural current of it pull you out, and then you'd float down river. And we would float down. It's hard to remember the distance. Distances were probably not as great as they seemed to me at the time, but I would imagine that we would go down at least a quarter of a mile in the river, and then there was a big sandbar came out, and we could climb out on the sandbar, and then we'd walk back up the shoreline and do it again. And we would do this over and over because it was a challenge, and it was real exciting. And the idea that you could dive off of this cement or jump off from it down into that whirlpool of water was a real challenge. And I always felt that I was strong enough in swimming and never had any real problem with doing that. And there were some of the guys our age who they would swim in the edge or go and wade out into the water and float down, but they didn't want to dive into the whirlpool. And one of the trips that we went out there, there was a guy went with us that had never been there before, but he was one of the star athletes in the school. He was always on the football team and the basketball and doing all kinds of sports. And when we got out there, he was very hesitant about going in, diving into that whirlpool, and it kind of surprised me that he felt that way because he was such a great athlete. And finally, the taunting of probably all the rest of us convinced him that he ought to try it. So he jumped in, and I went in right after him, just simply because of the timing. And we started to in the whirlpool, and it whirls you around, and you're underwater, and then you're on top and underwater. And all of a sudden, I realized that he wasn't joking when he appeared to be floundering, that he really was having a problem. So I swam over to him, took a hold of his arm, and pulled him out of the whirlpool, and then helped support him as we started to float down the river. and stayed with him. And when we got out on the sandbar and started up, I said, you know, I asked him, I said, did you get a cramp or something happen? And he says, no, I can't swim. And he said, I shouldn't have gone in the first place, but I did. And so he says, I really feel like you saved my life, because I had gotten into that whirlpool. There would have been no way I could have gotten out of there. So I always felt kind of good about the fact that I did have enough power in swimming to help somebody when they needed help. And like I say, I attribute that to my father, who taught us how to swim when we were very young. And I kind of tried to do that with our children as they grew up. I talked earlier about the fact that when we the house burned down, or at least the barn and the garage and all that part of the house burned out behind where we lived, behind the railroad depot. And then I took us moving directly to 17th Street, where they purchased the home. But there was, in between then, after we moved off the hill, we moved to a home on 14th Street. They rented again. It was a large home, an older home. Had lots of room. It was one of those kind of homes that in the front portion of it, there was a big living room, and then a big, like we would call now, a family room that I think they had used more as a big formal dining room. And there were sliding doors between them. And so you could open those doors, and it made one great big room. And they were hardwood floors. So I remember that when we lived there, why, there were very often that there were big parties, groups of the kids, probably all the older sisters and their friends would come, and they would hold dances and parties and everything in that in the parlor part of that home. And this was about the first time that my brother and I had ever really had a room of our own. Most of the houses that we lived in, we either slept in, you know, a substitute make-down bed in the living room or on a porch or somewhere. And in this house, there was plenty of room, and we had this big bedroom of our own upstairs at the back. And we soon found that we could go out the window of the home and across the roof of the little porch that was on the back, and then go down the drain pipe, and so we could come and go from our room without having to go through the rest of the house, and so that mother and dad didn't know whether we were in the house or not in the house. And we took advantage of that a few times, and we'd sneak out at night and go play with some of our friends in the park or somewhere. Another thing that we did a lot while we were there is we did a lot of roller skating. That had become a very popular sport. And we were only just a few blocks from the high school, and there was a big cement area around the high school, so there was a lot of area there to skate. The roller skates in those days were a lot different than the roller blades that they use today. The skates were four wheels, and most of the time metal wheels, and there were some people who had shoe skates where the shoes were actually built onto the skates, but most of us just had the skates. And the way they fastened on was on the front part of the skate, the front to the back was adjustable in length by undoing a little screw in the middle, and it was slotted, and so the toe part with the two front wheels, you could slide forward or back to make whatever your foot size was. And then on the front part, the front piece had two little clamps that come out of each side. They were just little half circle clamps, and they were on a set. They were fastened together with a set screw across between them, one half being a left hand thread and one half being a right hand thread. And you used a skate key, which was about the same as a key that would be used like to wind a big clock or something, and it just had a little hexagon opening in it. And you would put that on, you'd put your foot in the on the skate, then you'd take the skate key and tighten that up, and both those clamps would pull in from each side and pull right into the sole or over the sole of your shoe. And then on the heel part, there was a little base plate around the back of the heel, and a strap that would come up over, like a leather strap that would come up over your ankle, and then you could strap it tight from there. So the strap at the back held your heel on, and then these two clamps on the sole of your shoe held the front part of the skate on. And as I say, skating became a real popular sport, and we used to do a lot of skating. Most of the time when we were there on 14th Street is when I remember it the most. And we would go out and skate in the evenings, and whole groups of us would be together skating. I was also in the scout organization at that time, and I enjoyed scouting. We did some very good scout trips and had some good scout leaders that helped give me a lot of interest in and training in how to camp and how to handle yourself when you're out in the woods. When we went to Boise, when we moved there, there was only one ward in our church there, and it was out on Warm Springs Avenue, and it was a very small little white rectangular building. I would imagine the whole chapel floor wasn't over maybe 20 feet by 40 feet or 50 feet, and everyone met in the one building. And then in order to have classrooms, there were wires strung across above head level and curtains hanging from them, and when it was time for Sunday school or to have classes, you would pull the curtains across and divide it up into classrooms. The reason there wasn't quite as much congestion from that type of a situation was because the meetings were not all held together like they are now. We would go there for sacrament meeting on Sunday. Primary was held on an afternoon or after school on one of the days of the week. A Mutual Improvement Association, or the MIA, which included all the scouts and the beehives and all of the young women and young men's organizations, was held on one evening a week. Priesthood meeting was generally held. Sometimes the Sunday evening or Sunday afternoon at a different time than when the sacrament meeting was held, and also Sunday school then usually was held either right after or sometime in conjunction with sacrament meeting. So the meetings were spread out, and Relief Society was held on a morning one day during the week. The meetings were not consolidated like they are now, and so you were involved in going to church two or three different times a week if you went to your meetings. Our scout meeting was held on a Tuesday night usually, and there was a basement to the building, and that's where we would hold our scout meeting. And then they built a small building outside of the other one, and we held that as a scout house and a scout meeting. They built this other small building out there for that purpose. One interesting sidelight to when I was a scout, about the time that I was ordained a deacon and also in scouting, was my mother was called to be the president of the STAKE MIA, the STAKE Youth Organization for the Young Ladies. And the young man that was called to be the superintendent of the STAKE MIA was Ezra Taft Benson. And so he was working there in Boise. He was born over in Whitney, Idaho, which is over in the Cache Valley, but he had come to Boise because that was the state capital, and he was working in, I think, for the Department of Agriculture in Boise. In fact, I think the older girls, either Leola or Maud or both of them, at one time worked for him as a secretary and his secretary to him and his work there at the state capitol. And as I was saying, the scouting program took us out on some great outings. The year I was 15 years old, they had decided they wanted to build a new Boy Scout camp up at McCall, Idaho. It was on the Payette Lakes. And I was invited as one to go up there and help build that camp. It wasn't really like a scout outing per se, but it was to build a camp for the scouts. And we went up and cleared the land, cut brush, cut timber, helped to build some log cabins. We just did everything that would be to try to make a scout camp. And I spent the whole summer up there. And we slept in tents and they fed us. They fed us real good. And we were right on the Payette Lake, so every evening after we got through work, well, we'd go and jump in the lake and swim. And so it was a pretty delightful summer, even though it was very hard work. And I was 15 years old, and I probably grew more in those 3 months than I had any one particular time all my life. My brother and I, only being 21 months apart in age, were very close to the same size and weight and height almost all of our life until that particular summer. And when I came home to go to school in the fall, I was almost 6 inches taller than he was just from that one summer of such hard work and so much food. And it was quite a change, but then within a few years he caught up to me again, so we still are almost the same size and have been the rest of our lives. One interesting thing, that little sidelight that happened while we were up there, the man that was in charge of us was quite strict and really a real good leader and kept us all in line real good. And he had to go into McCall one night and said, well, he thought he would stay over because he had to get all the supplies and bring stuff out the next morning. So we were there, and he left his younger brother in charge, and he was probably in his 20s. And he had a lot more sense of humor and a lot less responsibility than his older brother. So as we sat around the evening meal, he frantically brought in a report that two men had escaped from the Idaho State Prison down there by Boise, and they were headed that way, and one of them was an axe murderer, and they were very dangerous, and that we had to be very careful. And so he organized all of us and put us into teams and made us get our flashlights and stationed us out in the woods all around outside of where our camp was, and said, now if anybody hears anything or sees anything, why, be sure. And they worked out a signal arrangement to where we would signal to the others and let them know if somebody was coming. And he built this up to where he had all of these young boys, myself included, he had us all just about half scared to death as to what was going to happen with this. So we all got out on our stands and with our flashlights, and of course no sleeping bags or anything. We just had to, we were just out in the woods. And he left us out there most of the night. And finally, I guess his conscience got the better, and he finally came out and started rounding us up and brought us all in about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And so we did get a little bit of sleep before we had to get up and go to work again. And when his brother came in that next morning and found out what he had done, boy, he just was so mad at his brother for for doing that to us kids. But we kind of ended up joking about it and thinking that was a pretty funny gag that the guy had pulled, that he had us all scared to death that these criminals were going to come and didn't know whether they were going to try to murder us or what they were going to do. So we had a scary night out in the woods. The church, as I say, when we went there, only had the one ward and a very small building. Then we helped. I don't know how much actual work I did, but I remember going over and helping some, because in those days, whenever they built a new ward, they would, it was built mostly by the labor of the members of the wards. And we helped to build the second ward while we were there, and it was a brick building, and really so much prettier and nicer and larger than the other one was that it was quite impressive. And then they had classrooms, and they had a place for a relief society, and they had a place for the scouts to meet, and it was really an exciting thing to see that development and a new ward there. The one thing about the old ward, the first ward, the organ that was in the church used for the music was a pump organ. Most of us know a pump organ if we do know anything about them, we see the ones where you pump with your feet. There are two pedals, and you pump those to build up the air supply through the bellows that supports the sound of music in the organ. And this organ that was in our ward out there on Warm Springs was a bellows and a pump organ, but the pump was a handle, kind of like a pump handle, on the side of the organ. So one of the duties of the Aaronic priesthood was you would be assigned a Sunday that it was your turn to pump the organ, and so whenever it was time for there to be music or the organist sat down to start to play, well, you had to step over to the side of the organ and pump that handle up and down to keep the bellows going and keep air going into the organ so that music would come out. And I remember that being an assignment very often when I was a deacon, and I would have to pump the organ while the music was, the hymns were being played and sung in the church. The interesting thing about the growth of the church, as we saw there, starting from just a one ward, we helped build a second. Before we left, why, there were actually more wards, and when we went back years later, why, then there are just multiples of wards. There are stakes, multiples of stakes internally of Boise, where the stake when we were there, there was the one stake, and it included over into Oregon, to a little town of Ontario. It included Caldwell, which was a town 35 miles away, Nampa, another town 30 miles the other way, Meridian, all the adjacent towns in a whole circle of maybe 40-50 mile radius, all were included in that one stake. And then when we went back in about 1975, I guess, when they had built a new temple in Boise, and now they had their own temple there, and we went up to go through it right after they dedicated it, because of it having been where we were raised. That was kind of an interesting experience. I'll probably tell a little more about that later when we come to that part of my life. I don't remember too much about the primary years. I guess my memory started kind of when I became a deacon and a scout, but one event that did take place in primary that was kind of interesting was my sister Maud was in charge, and probably the girls always taught primary and junior Sunday school, but Maud was in charge of producing a like a production, like a roadshow type of situation, which was very popular at that time, especially in the Mutual. They used to put on a road show. In fact, the Mutual organization was entirely different than it is now. It, as well as sponsoring scout troops and organizations for the girls to have activities, they also would hold plays. They had a drama department. They would hold musical performances, so they had a music department. They would hold dances and teach dancing and teach specialized dance numbers. And then they also had a speech department where they would teach public speaking and let the young people perform at certain occasions and in preparing their talks for church and so on. So those four culture departments were a very prominent and dominant part of the Mutual program. And I've since wondered sometimes if we didn't lose a little bit by them letting those programs go to the side. I remember how much enjoyment it was for me to learn to dance. My older sisters would use me to practice when they wanted to get all ready to go to dances, and so I learned to dance with them, and then we learned to dance at Mutual, and they actually had dance classes when they taught us the basic fundamentals of ballroom dancing and the different features of it. And then each year, when they would hold at the end of the year season in the spring, they would have a big dance that was called the Golden Green Ball. Those were the two colors for the MIA, as their colors, gold and green. And they would have this big dance at the end of the year, and they would have contests for it and performances, and they would have a queen of the Golden Green Ball. And I remember the last year we were there in Boise, Mary was the queen of that Golden Green Ball, and she and I danced together an exhibition dance that we qualified to go and dance with. This particular dance was taught all through the church, and then at the big festival that was held in connection with General Conference, Salt Lake City, then they held this big dance festival out at on the shores of the Great Salt Lake at a big dance hall and pavilion that they had out there called Salt Air. And Mary and I danced together. We came down from Boise and danced in that big dance festival out at Salt Air the last year before we moved from Boise. And so the dancing and the music and drama and speech were all an important part of that program. And I've digressed a little bit, but then back to in the primary, why they were holding this special, putting on a special show, and it was all about the story of back when the people had landed at Plymouth back in there in the New England area, and John Smith was one of the important ones of the ones who came in and settled, or at least in the story form they were. And I got to play John Smith in this production that Maud worked out, and I had this white satin-like outfit with the big flower or feathered hat like they wore in the French, the French type of the hat. And then Carlisle and two others of our friends, the Anderson boys, Kirk and Junior, they were part of them, and they played the Indians. And so I still have some pictures of me in that elaborate costume to play John Smith, and the boys dressed up as Indians. And that's a pretty fond memory of primary days while we were still in Boise. I made reference earlier about the church in Boise, the fact that there was just one ward when we went there, and it was rather a small building, and everyone worked to maintain it and keep that as our place of worship. And then we also helped build a second ward, which was a brick building. Let me give you a little background of the church situation in those days. The chapels built for service in each ward were built by the members. We would, as a membership of a ward, we would hold different kinds of fundraising projects. It might be growing vegetables, it might be an orchard, it might be a field, it might be growing, raising some cattle, or all different sorts of work projects, and we would raise money from those projects, both for our accumulation toward the building fund to build the buildings, and also for the money as a budget to maintain and keep the buildings in repair. The amount of money raised by a ward or a stake was then matched on a percentage basis from church headquarters. Those were the funds used to buy materials or to hire some of the work done that couldn't be done by the members. But otherwise, almost all the work, building of the building itself, the electrical, the painting, everything was done by the members. So you felt like you were really part of a building when it was finished. You felt like you had put some of yourself into it, and I think perhaps that in a way that was a good thing, because people took better care of them because of that. They felt a responsibility that it was their, partly their building, and so they were very careful of them and took good care of them. The schedule of meetings was quite different in those days. I'm sure in different wards and different stakes they may have had different actual time schedules, but the basic situation was that all the meetings were held separately. As I recall, the priesthood meeting was held early Sunday morning for about an hour, and after the meeting was over with, there was time allowed for the people to go home, and for the men to go home and pick up the rest of their family and come back. And then Sunday school was probably at 10 o'clock and would be for an hour and a half, whatever the time allotment for Sunday school. An important part of Sunday school to me in those days was the fact that there was a music training period where the people of the congregation or the members of the ward were taught the hymns of the church. And I thought that was real important, and it was just as important to learn the music and the hymns as it was some of the other scriptures, as far as I was concerned. Later in the afternoon, you would go back again, probably around 3 o'clock, for sacrament meeting. After you had been home and had a chance to have lunch, and then you'd come back for a sacrament meeting held at a separate time. Primary was held one afternoon a week during the weekdays. The Mutual Improvement Association, or the MIA, which was the youth organization, was held on one evening during the week. And part of that, I talked about a little bit of the fact that in the MIA there were the four social graces, if you will, were taught, and they would usually be like on maybe your six weeks basis. You'd be taught during mutual for a period of the time. You'd be taught music, and then you would have your scout meeting, or the girls would have their beehives or their laurels or whatever the meetings they would have. And then for another 6 weeks in that opening portion, you'd be taught some of the abilities to do public speaking, and to do drama, to take parts in plays. And then for another 6 weeks, you would be taught the dancing class, and you'd be taught literally how to do ballroom dancing. I guess the speech and the drama were two different ones, so that you probably had a 6 weeks of speech, and then you had a 6 weeks of drama, and 6 weeks of dance, and 6 weeks of music. And those were very interesting to me, as well as the fact that we also were in scouting. We had good activities in scouting. We were taught how to take care of ourselves when we were out in the woods, concerning fires and building shelters and the various things concerned with that that I always appreciated and enjoyed, not only in the scouting, but also in the fact that Dad enjoyed camping. I'm not sure Mother ever enjoyed it as much as we did, because it was probably always more work for her. It's like Jeannie has said when we would go on a camping trip, that it requires her to do all the same things she did at home, only without all the conveniences. But I can remember some of the trips that we took as families, and they were real great. And almost every year we would go up and camp somewhere in the mountains or on a lake, up on Warm Lake or on the rivers or up on Payette Lakes. Up in the mountains there were some beautiful areas. I recall one trip that we took. The family that went with us, I think their name was Carden, and they had children about the same age as we were, so when we traveled together as two families, well, it gave us a whole bunch of kids all to play together. The camping was a little bit different than it is today. We did have a tent, and so the first things when we would get there was to set up camp was to pitch the tent, which was a pretty old-fashioned kind, and it meant erecting the poles and tying guy ropes down to the ground to hold it. And then to make our beds, we would each cut pine boughs. And you'd soon learn that the best thing to do was cut the soft ones. Douglas fir was pretty soft, and some forms of the pine was pretty soft. But you learn to stay away from spruce, because the spruce needles are very hard and sharp, and that didn't work so good. But you would cut these pine boughs and build sort of a mattress on the ground out of the pine boughs, and then you would lay a blanket or a quilt on top of the pine boughs, and then depending on how cold it was going to get, you'd lay another quilt or blanket or both on top of the bed so that you could keep warm at night. And we didn't have sleeping bags. These were all just quilts and blankets that you would lay out. And in order to try to help keep warm at night, and for space and for the amount of equipment we had, always two or three of us kids would all sleep together inside of those beds. Then we would also have to dig a little area and build a fire pit by putting rocks around this little bowl that we'd dig, and then we would put fire in there, and we would put two forked sticks, maybe three feet high, and we would put those into the ground with the fork up, and then one long stick across them over the top, over the fire area, so that would be a place where they could hang the kettles for heating water and for cooking food. The lanterns that we had for light were the old kerosene lanterns. About the only place anyone today would see something like that is probably in some of the old cowboy movies, where they show that you lifted the glass part up and lit a wick the wick went down into a little container of kerosene, and you'd light that and then put the chimney back over the fire, or the lighted part of it, so that that would give you light for a lantern. And we usually would take a couple of those, but they didn't last too long, and they weren't too satisfactory, so it meant that usually when it began to get dark, you might sit around the fire and tell stories and sing and have a interesting evening that way for a while. But pretty soon, as it began to get darker, that was time to go to bed. Everybody would go to bed when it was dark and get up when it was light. One of the times we were on a trip like that, we had gotten the camp all set up, and Dad started telling us stories about the particular area that we were in on that and had gone into for that camping trip. And he said that there were quite a few animals around and different things to watch for, and he explained to us that one of them was a real strange animal that lived up in that particular area. It was called a side hill ding-along, and strangeness of the animal was the fact that it ran around the hills all the time, and because of it running on the steep slopes like that, the two legs on one side had grown short and the other two legs on the other side had grown long, so it could go around the hill and keep pretty level. And then he said that if the animal wanted to turn around and come back the other way, then it had to turn itself wrong side out so that the two short legs were on the high side and the two long legs on the low side to come back around. He said they weren't real dangerous, but he says if they got frightened, that they might attack, so you'd have to really watch for them. And he says they made a cry, kind of a high-pitched cry, kind of like a mountain lion cry, and so to listen for that. He says another thing that they did, that they would try to scare you away before, they didn't want to attack if they didn't have to, and so they would try to scare you into leaving so they didn't have to attack you. And so what they would do is they'd roll rocks down the hill to try to scare you away. Well, he built this story all up to us kids, and of course we're about 8 and 9, 10 years old, and my brother and I, and I guess my sisters, were probably mid-teens, and so we all were intently listening to this story, and then we decided to go for a hike because it was still daylight and we had time before dinner. So we went for a hike, and he told us about where to go and that we'd see a little lake back in there and so on. And so we started on this hike, and we got about almost to the little lake going along, and all of a sudden we hear this kind of this weird cry up on the side of the hill, and we all started getting scared and wondered. And then all of a sudden here comes some rocks rolling down the hill, and we thought, oh sure, that's what that is, that's what Dad was telling us about, that's one of those side hill animals. And so we were all real scared about it, and then it just let out a great big scream and a bunch of rocks came down, and of course that really scared us, and we all took running back toward camp just as hard as we could go. And we ran into camp, and when we got there, we were all excited, and each one trying to tell Dad that we had seen one of these animals, and we were each trying to outdo the other, I guess, as far as talking to him is concerned. And he just sat there kind of nonchalant and listened to us telling about it. And all of a sudden, my older sister, Leola, noticed that the magazine he was sitting there holding was upside down, and she realized that he had just barely beat us into camp and grabbed a magazine to look like he's already there. So we all jumped on him and beat on him and told him, you know, because he had pulled a pretty good joke on us, and we all fell for it. And we thought that was pretty funny that he had gone up there and been on the mountain above us and rolled the rocks down and screamed like a cougar and scared us, and even us running back to camp, why he made it faster than we did and was there when we got into camp. All through the years, as we were being raised, Dad worked real hard. He was with the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company most of my growing up years, and it required lots of hours because many of the appointments that he had to make in order to meet with both the husband and wife in a family would have to be in the evening, so he would work office work and what he could during the day, and then he would go out on appointments many evenings a week. But it seemed like as hard as he worked and as much as he was gone, there was still time that we had family outings and we had good family times together. And the fact that Dad liked to fish, he taught us how to fish and we enjoyed it, and we would spend time fishing whenever we could. Almost always on the camping trips, we were either by a lake, on a lake, or by a stream. And then when we would, when he would go hunting, he would take us boys with him, and we loved to hunt. We enjoyed going with him. We enjoyed watching the dog work, and it was those were great times to raise with the family. And Mother was very patient. Mother was a